Escape Pod 157. May 8th, 2008. Today's story, A Small Room in Cobalt Town, by Michael Swanwick.
Hello and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely, and this week we're sponsored by Implied Spaces by Walter John Williams, now available from Nightshade Books. It has a sword with a wormhole in it. Do I really need to say more? I will after the story. So, we're at week 3 of our Hugo nominees series this year, and we have another fantasy story, this one from Michael Swanwick. Or it's a ghost story. Or it's a locked room mystery. It's distinctive, whatever it is. And we'll get right to it. We're pleased to present A Small Room in Cobalt Town. Mr. Swanwick lives in Philadelphia and has in his time received the Hugo, Nebula, Sturgeon, and World Fantasy Awards. He's the author of 7 novels and scores of short stories, which have appeared in Asimov's, Amazing, Omni, and The Other Usual Suspects, along with many, many anthologies. He has a fabulously strange website at michaelswanwick.com with answers to a lot of serious and silly questions. The list of credits for his website shows that it's maintained by a dozen people, including Gardner Dozois and James Patrick Kelly. So, this is a man with friends. This story first appeared in Asimov's last year in their May-June 30th anniversary issue, along with last week's Hugo nominee. That was a good issue. The story is read by the haunting voice of Cheyenne Wright of the webcomic Arcane Times and colorist of the great Phil Foglio comics Buck Godot, Zapgun for Hire, and one of my favorites, Girl Genius. He's also done artwork for Pinnacle Entertainment, Remember Deadlands, and Cheap Ass Games. You can find his site at arcanetimes.com. So get out on the streets and kiss some hands and shake some babies. It's story time.
A Small Room in Cobalt Town by Michael Swanwick.
That winter, Will LeFay held down a job working for a haint politician named Salem Toussaint. Chiefly, his function was to run errands while looking conspicuous they sold it. He fetched tax forms for the alderman's constituents, delivered stacks of documents to Trollis functionaries, fixed L&I violations, presented boxes of candy John the Conqueror wrote to retiring secretaries, absent-mindedly dropped slim envelopes containing $20 bills on desks. When somebody important died, he brought a white goat to the back door of the Fane of Darkness to be sacrificed to the Nameless One. When somebody else's son was drafted or went to prison, he hammered a nail in the Inkisi Encande that Toussaint kept in the office to ensure his safe return. He canvassed voters in haint neighborhoods like Ginigal, Beluthahatchee, and Diddy Wall Diddy, where the bars were smoky, the music was good, and it was dangerous to smile at the whores. He negotiated the labyrinthian bureaucracies of City Hall. Not everything he did was strictly legal, but none of it was actually criminal. Salem Toussaint didn't trust him enough for that. One evening, Will was stuffing envelopes with Ghostface while Jimmy B. Good went over a list of ward healers with the alderman, checking those who could be trusted to turn out the troops in the upcoming election, and crossing out those who had a history of pocketing the walking-around money and standing idle on election day, or worse, steering the vote the wrong way because they were double-dipping from the opposition. The door between Toussaint's office and the anteroom was open a crack, and Will could eavesdrop on their conversation.
"Grandfather Domovoy was turned to stone last August," Jimmy B. Good said. "So we're gonna have to find somebody new to bring out the Slovaks. There's a villa named—"
Ghostface snapped a rubber band around a bundle of envelopes and lofted them into the mail cart on the far side of the room.
"3 points," he said. Then, "You want to know what burns my ass?"
"No," Will said.
"What burns my ass is how you and me are doing exactly the same job, but you're headed straight for the top while I'm going to be stuck here licking envelopes forever. And you know why? Because you're solid."
"Well, that's just racist bullshit," Will said. "Toussaint never going to promote me any higher than I am now. Haints like seeing a fae tuckle to the big guy, but they'll never accept me as one of his advisors. You know that as well as I do." "Yeah, but you ain't going to be here forever, are you? In a couple of years, you'll be holding down an office in the mayoralty. Wouldn't surprise me one bit if you made it all the way to the Palace of Leaves. Either you're just buzzing my chops or else you a fool. Because if you meant it, you'd be a fool to be ragging on me about it. If Toussaint were in your position, he'd make sure I was his friend, and wherever I wound up, he'd have an ally. You could learn from his example.
Ghostface lowered his voice to a near whisper.
Toussaint's old school. I got nothing to learn from a glad-handing, pompous, shucking, jiving.
The office door slammed open. They both looked up. Salome Toussaint stood in the doorway, eyes rolled up in his head, so far that only the whites showed. He held up a hand, and in a hollow voice said, "One of my constituents is in trouble." The alderman was spooky in that way. He had trodden the streets of Babel for so many decades that his molecules had insinuated themselves into his body through a million featherlight touches on its bricks and railings. Its bars and brothel doors, its accountant's office and barking garages, and his own molecules in turn been absorbed by the city, so there was no longer any absolute distinction between the two. He could read Babel's moods and thoughts, and sometimes, as now, it spoke to him directly. Toussaint grabbed his Homburg and threw his great coat over his arm.
"Jimmy, stay here and arrange for a lawyer. We can finish that list later. Ghostface, Will, you boys come with me."
The alderman plunged through the door. Ghostface followed. Will hurried after them, opening the door and closing it behind him, then running to make up for lost time. Ghostface doubled as Toussaint's chauffeur. In the limo, he said,
"Where to, boss?"
"Cobalt Town. A haint's been arrested for murder, and we gotta get him off."
"You think he was framed?"
Will asked.
"What the fuck difference does that make? He's a voter."
Cobalt Town was a transitional neighborhood, with all the attendant tensions. There are lots of haints on the streets, but the apartment building the police cars were clustered about had sprigs of fennel over the doorway to keep them out. Salem Toussaint's limousine pulled up just in time for them to see a defiant haint being hauled away in Rowanwood handcuffs. The bead at the end of his doopy braids clicked angrily as he swung his head around.
"I ain't done nothing," he shouted. "This is all bullshit, motherfucker. I'm gonna come back and kill you all."
His eyes glowed hellishly, and an eerie blue nimbus surrounded his head. Clear indicators that he'd been shooting up Crystal Goon. Will was surprised he was even able to stand. The limo came to a stop, and Will hopped out to open Salem Toussaint's door. Toussaint climbed ponderously out and stopped the guards with an imperious gesture. He then spoke briefly with their captive.
"Go quietly, son. I'll see you get a good lawyer. The best money can buy."
Will flipped open his cell, punched a number, and began speaking into it in an earnest murmur. It was all theater. He'd dialed the weather, and Jimmy B. Good had doubtlessly already engaged a defender. But combined with Toussaint's presence, it calmed the haint down. He listened carefully as the alderman concluded.
"Just don't get yourself killed. That's the important thing, understand?"
The haint nodded. In the lobby, two officers were talking with the doorman. All three stiffened at the sight of haints walking in the door, relaxed when they saw Will restoring the twigs of fennel, and smiled with relief as they recognized Toussaint. It all happened in a flicker, but Will saw it. And if he noticed, how could his companions not? Nevertheless, the alderman glided in, shaking hands and passing out cigars, which the police acknowledged gratefully and stowed away in the inside pockets of their coats.
"What's the crime?" he asked.
"Murder," said one of the cops.
Toussaint whistled once, low and long, as if he hadn't already known.
"Which floor?"
"Second."
They waited for the elevator, though the stairs were handy, and it wouldn't have been faster to walk. Salem Toussaint would no more have climbed those stairs than he would have driven his own car. He made sure you understand what a big Mahaffey was, before he slapped you on the back and gave your nice horse a sugar cube. As the doors opened, Toussaint turned to Ghostface and remarked,
"You're looking mighty grim. Something the matter?"
Ghostface shook his head stiffly. He stared unblinking straight ahead of himself, all the way to their destination. There were two detectives in the frigid apartment, both twith-teg, golden-skinned and leafed-eared, in trench coats that looked like they had been sent out to be professionally rumpled. They turned, annoyed, when the cop standing guard at the door let the three of them in, then looked resigned as they recognized the alderman.
"Schulpe! Zeithuthros!"
Toussaint slapped backs and shook hands as if he were working a room at a campaign fundraiser.
"You're looking good, the both of you."
"Welcome to our humble crime scene, Salem," Detective Zeithuthros said. He slipped a hand to take in the room. One window, half open, with the cold winter air still flowing in through it. Its sill, and the wall beneath, black with blood. The burglar bars looked intact. A single dresser, a bed, a chair that had been smashed to flinders. a dribble of blood that led from the window to my tiny bathroom with the door thrown wide. I should have known you'd show up. Bogart sprawled lifelessly on the bathroom floor. Its chest had been ripped open. There was a gaping hole where the heart should have been. "Who's the stiff?" Toussaint asked. "Name's Bobby Begain. Just another lowlife. I see you hold off an innocent haint. Now, Salem, don't be like that. It's an open and shut case. The door was locked and bolted from the inside. Burglar bars on the window and a sprig of fennel over it. The only one who could have gotten in was the spook. He worked as a janitor here. We found him sleeping it off on a cot in the basement. Haint." Salem Toussaint's eyes were hard. "Please." After the briefest of pauses, the detective said, "Haint. Give me the story." "About an hour ago, there was a fight. Body slamming against the wall, furniture smashing. Everybody in the hall complained. By the time the concierge got here, it was all over. She called us. We broke in." "Why didn't the concierge have a key?" "She did. Begain put in the deadbolt. You can imagine what the old bat had to say about that." "Why wasn't there a haint ward on the door?" "Didn't need one. Doorman in the lobby? Only one haint in the building." Will squinted at the wall above the door. "There's a kind of pale patch up there, like there used to be a ward and somebody took it down." Detective Schulpe, the quiet one, turned to stare at him. "So?" "So, what kind of guy installs a deadbolt that takes down the ward? That doesn't make sense. The kind who likes to invite his haint buddy over for a shooting party every now and then." Detective Zeisuthros pointed towards the dresser with his chin. A set of used works lay on top of it. Concierge says they were so thick that some of the neighbors thought they were fags. Turned back to Toussaint. "Alderman, if you want to question our work here, fine, go ahead. I'm just saying there's not a lot of hope for the boy." "Will's right," Ghostface said, and went to the window. "And another thing, look at all the blood on the sill. This is where it happened. So how the hell did he get all the way into the bathroom? Somebody ripped his heart out, so he decided to wash his hands?" Now both detectives were staring at him hard. "You don't know much about Bogarts," Zeisuthros said. "They're tough. They can live for 5 minutes with their heads ripped off. A heart's nothing. And yeah, that's exactly what he did. Wash his hands. Old habits go last. One of the first things we did was to turn off the water. Otherwise, I thought the concierge was going to have a seizure." Ghostface looked around wildly. "Well, what happened to the heart? Why isn't it here? I suppose you think a haint ate it, huh? I suppose you think we're all cannibals." In a disgusted tone, Detective Zeisuthros said, "Get Sherlock Holmes Jr. the fuck out of here." Salem Toussaint took Ghostface by the elbow, led him to the door. "Why don't you wait outside?" Ghostface turned to gray, but he stamped angrily out of the room and down the hall. Will followed. He didn't have to be told that this was part of his job. Outside, Ghostface went straight to the alley below Begain's window. There were no chalk marks or crime scene tape, so the police obviously hadn't found any evidence there. Nor was there a heart laying in the pavement. A dog or a night gaunt could have run off with it, of course, but there was no blood either, except for a stain under the window, and maybe a stray drop or two that couldn't be seen in the dark. "So, what happened to the heart?" Ghostface paced back and forth, unable to keep still. "It didn't just fly away." "I don't know," Will said. "You be Begain." Ghostface slapped a hand against the brick wall. "Here's the window. You stand here, looking out at it. Now I come up behind you. How do I rip your heart out in a way that leaves all that blood on the windowsill? From behind you, I can't get at your heart. If you turn around and face me, the blood doesn't splash on the sill. Now, those ignorant Pricklewood detectives probably think I could shove my hands through Begain's back and push his heart out, but it don't work like that. Two things can't occupy the same space at the same time. If I make my hands solid while I'm inside your chest, I'm going to fuck them up seriously. So I don't come at you from behind."
"Okay."
"But if you turn around so I can come at you from the front, the blood's not going to spray over the sill, is it? So I got to be between you and the window. I don't know if you noticed, but Ice didn't have any blood on him. None. Zip. Nada. Maybe you think I could rip somebody's heart out and then make myself insubstantial fast enough that the blood would spray through me? I don't think so. But even if I could, the blood's going to splatter all over the floor, too. Which it didn't. So you tell me. How could I rip your heart out and leave the blood all over the sill like that?"
"You couldn't."
"Thank you. Thank you. That's right. You couldn't."
"So?" Will said.
"So there's something fishy going on, that's all. Something suspicious. Something's wrong."
"Like what?" I don't know. Abruptly, Ghostface's hands fell to his side. Just like that, all the life went out of him. He slumped despondently. I just don't know. Ghostface, Will said. Why does all this matter? You called this guy Ice. What's he to you? The Haint's face was as pale as ash, stiff as bone, and in a stricken voice he said, He's my brother. They went to a diner across the street and ordered a coffee. Ghostface stared down at his cup without drinking. Ice always was a hard case. He liked the streets too much. He liked the drugs. He liked the thug life. That's why he never made anything of himself. Ghostface picked up a spoon, looked at it, set it down. I don't know. Maybe he did it. Maybe he did.
You know he didn't. You proved he couldn't have.
Yeah, but that's not going to convince a judge now, is it? Will had to admit, it would not.
You guys keep in touch?
Not really. I saw him a few months ago. He was all hopped up and talking trash about how he finally made a big score. He was gonna be smoking $100 cigars and betting $1,000 whores. Maybe he stole something. Told him to get the hell out. I didn't want to know anything about his criminal activities. My own brother. Last time I saw him, I told him to go to hell. They were silent for a bit.
Nobody said anything about finding anything valuable, Will observed.
Sometimes the cops will pocket that kind of stuff.
Well, that's true. Will dipped a finger into his coffee and drew the sigil of inspiration on the linoleum counter.
Nothing came to him. He sighed. What would the big guy do in this situation?
Him?
Ghostface said bitterly. Probably hand out cigars.
Hey, Will sat up straight. That's not a half bad idea. It's pretty cold out there.
He counted cops through the window. Then he called the waitress over. Give me 4 large coffees, cream and sugar on the side. Leaving Ghostface hunched over the counter, Will carried the cardboard tray out to where the police stood stamping their feet to keep warm. They accepted the gift with small nods. All 4 had dark skin and short horns, the kind of attitude that came from knowing they'd never, ever make detective. The oldest of the lot said,
Working for the spook, are ya?
Oh, Salem's okay. The cop grinned on one side of his oak-brown face. You're what the mix would call his hound a hoolan. You know what that is?
No, sir.
It means that if he says he wants to drive,
you bend over and bark.
The cops all laughed. Then 3 of them wandered away, leaving only the rookie. Will took out a pack of Marlboros, offered one, took one for himself, then lit both. They smoked them down to the end without saying much. Will flicked his butt away. The rookie pinched the coal off of his and ate it. Finally, Will said, This Bougain guy, you know him?
Everybody knew him. Real bad character. In jail as often as not. Girlfriend's cute, though. Used to come to the station and bail him out. Skinny little thing, no tits to speak of. Big lugs always like him petite, you ever notice?
Some of the neighbors thought he was queer.
They sure wouldn't have said that to his face. Bougain was a bruiser. Used to fight some under the name of, Do the Hand the Deathless.
No kidding, Will said. His gym anywhere around here?
Down the street and over a couple blocks. Place called the Sucker Punch. Can't miss it.
Ghostface was still in the diner. So Will left a note on the dash of the limo. A few minutes later, he was at the Sucker Punch, AC. If there was one thing that Will had learned working for Toussaint, it was how to walk through any front door in the world and act as if he had a perfect right to be there. He went in. The gym was dark and smelled serious. Punching bags hung from the gloom. Somebody grunted in a slow, regular fashion like a mechanical pig from the free weight area. There was a single, regulation ring in the center of the room. A troll weight bounced up and down on his toes, shadowboxing.
Go home, little boy,
an ogre in a pug hat said.
There ain't nothing here for you.
Oh, it's not about that, sir, Will said quickly, by that meaning whatever the ogre thought it meant. The alderman had schooled him never to meet aggression head-on.
No, you don't want to build yourself up, get the girl, and beat the crap out of whoever's pushing you around.
The ogre squeezed Will's biceps.
You could use it. Only not here. This is a serious club for serious fighters only.
No, sir. I'm with Alderman Toussaint. By the ogre's expression, Will could see that he recognized the name and was not impressed.
I was hoping you could tell me something about Bobby Bougain.
The bum. What he's done now?
He was murdered.
Well, I ain't surprised. Bougain was no damn good. Could have worked his way up to the middle of the card, but he wasn't willing to put in the effort. Always jerking off somewhere with his spook buddy when he should have been working out.
Somebody said they got into doing crimes together?
It was a shot in the dark, but Will figured the odds were good.
Yeah, well, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised. There's a lot of crap a gorilla like Bougain can pull off if he's got a hanged accomplice. You go into a jewelry store and pinch the ward, and the guy ain't looking and replace it with a sprig of plastic fennel. Then at night, the spook slips in and shoves off the alarm. If you're like Bougain and can rip the safe door off its hinges, you can walk off with a bundle. Somebody pulled something like that out of a warehouse down in the village about 6 months ago. Got away with a fortune in slabs of raw jade. I remember it because Bougain quit the gym right after that. And I always wondered.
Raw jade's got to be hard to sell, though, Will said.
I mean, in bulk. Not if you got connections. Even if you don't. Something like that could be moved through your regular fence, provided you waited until things had cooled down some. Not that I know personally, but you hear things.
Huh, Will said. This girlfriend of his, you remember her name?
Nah. Dyra, Damia, something like that. Maybe Danae. Only reason I recollect it all is that I asked Bougain once, was she a pixie or Ruskala or what? And he said she was Deneer. Deanira the Deneer, that was it. That's a new one on me. I thought I knew all the ethnics, but I ain't never heard of a Deneer before. Listen, kid, I really got work to do.
I'll be out of your way then, Will said. Thanks for your help. He took one last look around the gym. I guess Bougain should have stayed in the ring.
Oh, he wasn't a ring boxer, the ogre said. He was a pit boxer.
What's the difference?
Pit boxing's strictly death match. Two fighters climb down, only one climbs out. Bougain had a 3-2 record when he quit.
How the fuck, Will said, can somebody have a 3-2 record when he's fighting to the death?
The ogre grinned. Then he explained. Less than an hour later, Will, Salem Toussaint, and Ghostface stood waiting in the shadows outside the city morgue.
Okay, Ghostface said. I thought I knew all the racial types, from Litvat night hags to Thai shit demons, but you say this girl? So what?
A Danea. It's not a type, it's a job. A Deneer is a morgue assistant who's responsible for moving and cleaning the body. She also assists the coroner in the autopsy. I made a few calls, and Deneer's on night duty this week, though I'm guessing she might take off a little early tonight.
Why is that? This is where Bobby Bougain's body wound up.
I think, boy, Toussaint said firmly, you'd best tell us the whole story.
All right, Will said. Here's how I put it together. Bougain and Ice steal a truckload of jewelry-grade jade together and agree to wait 6 months before trying to fence it. Bougain keeps possession. I'm guessing it's stashed with his girlfriend, but that's not really important. And everyone has half a year to reflect on how much bigger Bougain's share will be if he stiffs Ice. Maybe Ice starts worrying about it out loud. So Bougain goes down to the basement to talk it over with his good buddy. They have a couple of drinks. Maybe they smoke a little crack. Then he breaks out the crystal goon. By this time, your brother's lost whatever good judgment he had in the first place and says, sure.
Ghostface nodded grimly.
Ice shoots up first. Then Bougain. Only he shoots up pure water. That's easy to pull. What druggie is going to suspect another druggie of shortchanging himself? Then, when Ice nods off, Bougain goes back to his room, takes down the ward, flushes it down the toilet. That way, when he's found dead, suspicion's naturally going to fall on the only individual in the building able to walk through a locked door. One who he's made certain will be easy to find when the police come calling. So who kills Bougain? It's a setup job. Bougain opens the window halfway and checks to make sure his girlfriend's waiting in the alley. Everything's ready. Now he stages a fight. He screams, roars, pounds on the wall, smashes a chair, and then, when the neighbors are all yelling at him to shut up, he goes to the window, takes a deep breath, and rips open his ribcage with his bare hands.
He can do that?
Bogarts are strong, remember? Plus, if you checked out the syringe on his dresser, I wouldn't be surprised to find traces not of goon, but morphine. Either way, with or without a painkiller, he tears out his own heart. Then he drops it out the window. Deonira catches it in a basket, or a sheet, so there's no blood on the ground. Nothing that'll direct the investigator's attention outside. She leaves with his heart. Now Bougain's still got a couple of minutes before he collapses. He's smart enough not to close the window. There'd be blood on the outside part of the sill, and that would draw attention outward again. But his hands are slick with blood, and he doesn't want the detectives to realize he did the deed himself. So he goes to the bathroom sink and washes them. By this time, the concierge is hammering on the door. He dies. Everything's going exactly according to plan.
Hell of a plan, Toussaint murmured.
Yeah, you know the middle part. The cops come, they see, they believe. If it wasn't for Ghostface kicking up a fuss, we never would have found this other stuff.
Me? I didn't do anything.
Well, it looked hinky to me, but I wasn't going to meddle in police business until I learned it mattered to you.
You left out the best part, Toussaint said. How Bougain manages to turn killing himself into his own advantage.
Yeah, that had me baffled too, but when a boxer picks up a nickname like The Deathless, you have to wonder why. Then the ogre at the gym told me that Bougain had a 3-2 record pit boxing. That's to the death, you know. Turns out Bougain's got a glass heart, big lump of crystal the size of your fist. No matter how badly he's injured, the heart can repair him, even if he's clinically dead.
So his girlfriend waits for the body to show up and sticks the heart back in?
Ghostface said.
No, that's just crazy. That wouldn't work, would it?
Shh, Will said. I think we're about to find out.
Look.
A little door opened on the side of the morgue. Two figures came out. The smaller one was helping the larger to stand. For the first time all evening, Toussaint smiled. Gold teeth gleamed. Then he put a police whistle to his mouth. After Bougain and his girlfriend had been arrested, Ghostface gave Will a short, fierce hug and then ran off to arrange his brother's release. Will and the alderman strolled back to the limousine, parked two blocks away. As they walked, Will worried how he was going to explain to his boss that he couldn't chauffeur because he didn't have a license.
You done good, boy,
Salem Toussaint said.
I'm proud of you.
Something in his voice, and perhaps the amused way he glanced down at Will out of the corner of his eye, said more than mere words could have.
You knew, Will said. You knew all the time.
Toussaint chuckled.
Perhaps I did, but I had the advantage of knowing what the city knows. It was still mighty clever of you to figure it out all on your own.
But why should I have to? Why didn't you just tell the detectives what you knew?
Let me answer that question with one of my own. Why did you tell Ghostface? He was the one who uncovered the crime.
They had reached the limo now. It flickered its lights on, glad to see them. But they didn't climb in just yet.
Because I gotta live with the guy.
I don't want him thinking I'm superior to him.
Exactly so. The police liked hearing the story from a solid boy better than they would from me. I'm not quite a buffoon in their eyes, but I'm something close to it. My power has to be respected, and my office, too. Would make folks nervous if they had to take me seriously as well.
Alderman, I...
Hush up, boy. I know everything you're about to say.
The alderman opened the door for Will.
Climb in back. I'll drive.
And that was our story. The mark of a good mystery story for me is when I don't know who done it before the characters find out. The mark of a really good mystery story is when it doesn't really matter. This week we have another book sponsor. We're brought to you by Nightshade Books and Walter John Williams' novel Implied Spaces. This is a wild adventure novel that has a lot of the images of fantasy implemented as science fiction. Our hero, Aristide, is a programmer and swordsman traveling through pocket universes created by godlike AIs. He has a terribly cool sword, he has a talking cat that's really more than it seems, and he's the only one who can stop a terrible plot that could bring about the end of all the universes. I've been reading an advanced copy of this and enjoying it a lot. It's only the second Walter John Williams novel I've read, and he's got a great sense for settings you'll remember. If you like your SF with head-tripping ideas and a lot of action, you'll find this one a lot of fun. Again, the novel is Implied Spaces, and it's available everywhere in a few weeks. You can go to our site for an Amazon link. If you buy it there, you'll save about a third off the cover price and support Escape Pod. So, be back on Escape Pod 153, Robert Silverberg's story about an anthropologist with nothing left to study but his own imagination, Schwartz Between the Galaxies. I actually got an angry email last week from someone who got confused by our timeline and accused me of skipping over this story's feedback. No, I didn't skip it, though I admit it's tempting. We'll start off with the positive comments. That won't take long. Brian spoke for several other fans of the story's thesis when he said, "This didn't ring any bells with you guys about the Starbuckification of our culture? I thought on that level it had a really strong pull." Chodon praised it specifically because its message that we will never get into space depressed him, and any story that provokes a strong emotional reaction must be a success. He said, "I want to go cry now. I feel like I've just been told there's no Santa Claus." Even those who liked the story agreed that it felt dated, and that the protagonist's views about race and culture should be taken as his own biases and not at face value. Lead Minion said, "I enjoyed this story, just as I usually enjoy stories with insane main characters. Schwartz is supposed to be hypocritical and unreliable." And those were the fans. Those who didn't like the story really didn't like the story. The word offensive was used often, and many objected to the bad anthropology in it, even for the 1970s in which it was written. Rachel wrote, "I was with this story until the word primitives was used. It makes me want to bang my head on the keyboard and ask what was the last 100 years of cultural anthropology study for, but to prove this very word wrong to use in relation to cultures and people." Hans wrote, "I was completely put off by the depressive soapbox rambling of the main character, and he was one of many who said they stopped listening partway in." A lot of people complained about the lack of action, a lot of people complained about the sexism of the stewardess character. We even had Arvidwi stepping up to protest the story's unfair treatment of Yale economists. So, yeah, this one was not really a winner. To all of those who hated it, I'm sorry. Next week we'll have different words in a different order. I don't have a quote of the week on this story, but instead two thoughts of the week that spurred tangents in the discussion thread. The first was Nobilis, who said, "The nagging thought that spoiled the whole story for me was, it didn't happen that way. He's wrong. Culture wasn't destroyed, it was transformed. Instead of Californians and New Yorkers and Londoners and Liberians, you have Republicans and veterans and furries and soccer moms and Unitarians and podcasters. Cultures exist in as much variety as they used to. You just can't go looking for them by flying around." The second thought was from Peter, and I'm going to have to quote this at length. He in turn is citing a thought experiment from Thomas de Zangotita's book, Mediated. He writes, "Suppose that it was possible that the entire population of Earth would be guaranteed sufficient food, water, medical care, education, and so on, and there would be no more war or poverty. The catch is that, in this world, no matter where you go, from Siberia to Argentina to Madagascar to New Zealand, everywhere looks like a Southern California suburb. This is guaranteed to get people talking about cultural diversity, how material conditions affect culture, the unfeasibility of Earth supporting 6 billion people at that level of consumption. But even that sidesteps the issue of who gets to decide. Ask the question of some child soldier or HIV-infected prostitute in Central Africa, and would they give a damn about cultural diversity?" Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it all you like, but don't sell it or change it. If you like this week's story, we hope you'll tell a friend or blog about it. And if you really enjoy what we're doing, please consider donating via the PayPal link at our site so that we can continue to support our authors. Also check out our fantasy podcast, Podcastle, and our horror podcast, Pseudopod, both at their .org domains. Our music is by permission of Daikaiju. You can hear more from them at daikaiju.org. That was our show for this week. We'll be back next week with the last of our Hugo nominees. Our closing quotation comes from science fiction grandmaster and recent haint Arthur C. Clarke, who said, "Behind every man now alive stand 30 ghosts, for that is the ratio by which the dead outnumber the living." We'll see you next week. Have fun.